How was your childhood, and what was it like growing up in the 70s?
My childhood was in the 60s and 70s, and we did a lot of stuff by ourselves, like go out in the woods and stuff.
It's like independent.
And very independent.
Yeah.
Yep. There were no cell phones. So when we were out in the woods, absolutely nobody knew where we were. Nobody could get in touch with us. We were just out, and we lived pretty rural. So we would wander around the woods for miles and miles and miles. Huh. And the car engines kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. They had like the muscle cars in the late 60s and the early 70s. Until the gas crisis hit by the late 70s. And then all of a sudden, all the cars got really small and really weak. And that was quite a shock to go from monster big cars to small underpowered cars. Mm-hmm. And the 70s, I think we lost our fashion sense and had really crazy clothes. I think the end of the 60s, early 70s, we had really crazy clothes. And maybe surprising now, but I had really long hair. I know. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah. Well, almost everybody had long hair back then. So,
was it like more of a trend?
It was the way it was. Yeah. Everybody had long hair. So I actually had to trim my hair like so it didn't go down to my shoulders and stuff. Had really long hair. Everybody did.
Okay. So, this is like a side question, but were there any like crazy like toys or trends that you can remember?
That's a good question. I don't remember anything special. I mean, we did have pet rocks, I believe, back then.
Oh yeah.
I think the Chia Pet started back then, and mm-hmm. I think that's still going.
Did you watch like the moon landing?
Yeah, everybody watched the moon landing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was huge. That was absolutely huge. So,
all right. What was your best childhood memory? If you could like pick it down to one.
My best childhood memory was probably riding bikes in the woods. We had these bikes that we built from parts we found in the trash.
Oh.
People would throw out bike parts, and my friend and I, we didn't have a lot of money, and his dad had a welding machine. So we would scour the trash, and anytime we found a really nice bike part or bike, we would just grab it out of the trash and then take the part that we needed and get it onto our bike. So we created these like, I can't even describe what it would be like. It's not like today's mountain bike. It's not even like a BMX bike, but these were like kind of off-road bikes that you could ride. And then it was a lot of fun. Then we would ride them around the woods all the time.
Because, like, the woods were, like, right in your backyard, right?
Yeah, my parents live with, they have a good acre of woods just behind their house. But just down the road where my friend lived was miles of woods. I don't even know how many acres. I mean, just miles and miles of woods. You could just keep walking forever. There was nothing back there.
Wow.
And we just, you know, we would go and we'd camp out. There was a gorge with a ravine and a little river at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And we would just go out there and, you know, sometimes we'd stay out there the whole day and have a vine to swing on and take fireworks and stuff and blow them up and take the BB guns out and shoot up stuff. So that's what we used to do all summer long. We'd go out in the woods and sometimes camp out, sometimes not.
That's cool, yeah.
Yeah.
What was your first job? Did you like it? What did it teach you?
So my first commercial job, usually I worked for myself. I had a lawn mowing business. I had a snow plow business. But the first actual like commercial job was as a busboy at a little pizza shop at the top of my street. And I would go, and I was working probably like 3-4 days a week during the summer, sometimes more if they were really busy. And I'd work an 8-hour shift, and I just grabbed the dishes from the table and loaded them in the dishwasher and took them out. And it was hot and sweaty work because you're working in the summertime and you're in a small kitchen. And when you open up that commercial dishwasher, the steam just comes flying out at you. And then you got to take the dishes and put them out, and then you got to go back out and bust the tables. And I was working really hard, and I was making minimum wage at the time, which was $2 an hour. That's what I made. And I was supposed to get 10% of the tips from the waitress. So every night she would come to me and she would say, I don't remember her name, but she would come and say to me, "Oh, it was kind of a slow night." And she'd hand me like $2. And that was it. And that was every single night. "Oh, it was a slow night. Hand me $2. Oh, it was a slow night. Hand me $2. And then one night I was bussing tables and somebody left a $20 tip. And I'm thinking, well, that's $2 right there. 10%, right?
Right.
I'm like, I'm going to have a good night, man. I'm going to get some money tonight. Yeah, because look at that. Right there is $2. So I was bussing tables, and I was all happy because, you know, it was going to be a real nice payday. And at the end of the night, she came up to me and said, "Oh, it's been a slow night," and handed me $2. And I was like, "You lying." I quit right then and there. Never went back.
I don't blame you.
No, never went back. I was like, that's it. I'm done. So I just stuck with my lawn mowing business and my snow plow business.
So you're just like more of an entrepreneur.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, I made much more money on my own.
Did like the work teach you anything?
Or? Yeah. Yeah. The work taught me to get an education, to get a better job, one thing, and to always watch out for the money because people cheat. That lady cheated me all summer, every single night. She cheated me. I mean, who knows how much money I was supposed to make because the way they got away with paying me the $2 an hour was because I was in the restaurant business and I was supposed to be getting more money by tips. And this lady was just basically stealing from me the whole summer. So that was the end of that. So yeah, that taught me a really good lesson. Watch out. People steal. Always got to watch out for your money. Make sure you're getting paid appropriately. It was bad.
Where and what did you study for college? Best experience, worst experience?
So I went to college at Boston University, and it was a really fun experience because I had never been in a city like Boston before to live. We had visited Boston a few years before, but living there and being out on my own pretty much, didn't know anybody in Boston at all. Didn't even know anybody from Ohio who was up there. I met a few people from Ohio, but I didn't know them. And that was a really great experience. And I knew I wanted to go to med school, so I took the pre-med required courses, but I didn't know what I wanted to major in college. I had no idea what I wanted to major in college. So I just studied and did my pre-med stuff and did some basic stuff because there are some basic courses that you have to take to graduate with a liberal arts degree. You have to do a certain amount of English. You have to do a certain amount of foreign language. It does not matter what your major is. These were requirements. So I started on those requirements. I started on the pre-med requirements. And then at the end of my sophomore year, I still had not declared a major. I still did not know what I wanted to major in. And I get a letter from the dean of the school, and I'll never forget. The dean basically wrote saying, you have to declare a major or you're not invited back. Don't come back if you don't pick a major. So then I was like, oh boy. So I looked around at all the different majors, and some majors I couldn't even do at that point, like math, because you have to have a certain amount of math classes. Not that I wanted to. But the major that stood out was psychology, because it had the fewest requirements. So it allowed me to do my pre-med requirements, psychology requirements, and still have a couple little slots left over for something fun. Because I wanted to take something, you know, fun, because the basic courses aren't fun. Basic courses are just like you know, your high school courses. But once you get to be a junior and a senior, then you get to real fun stuff, all the electives. And that's when you take stuff you want to take, not because you have to take it. And I really wanted to take a whole bunch of different courses to be exposed to them. And so I picked psychology as my major. And then psychology forced me to take some philosophy classes. And I ended up liking the philosophy classes so much, I kept taking them, and I ended up getting a minor in philosophy with that. So that was a really great experience, and I'm super glad I did it, but there was no plan there. I just kind of fell into that. Yeah.
Were there any bad experiences, or were it just like
pretty? Yeah. No, there were. The living in the dorm was really challenging. I was living in a dorm called Warren Towers, which is the largest non-military housing facility in the United States. There's something like 1,500 students, three towers of 500 students each tower. It's huge. And it wasn't a great experience. It was really chaotic and busy, and the cafeteria was like, you know, like eating at an airport every day, because it's just so busy. And, you know, the bathroom, you had so many people on your floor. The bathroom was like, you know, you had to go to a shower and stuff like that. There was nothing personal about it. It was very industrial. And then the room was small, and we had no air conditioning. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Boston in the springtime, it can crank. It can get pretty hot. And you got no AC, and so that wasn't the best experience, but you're required to live in a dorm the first year. Most colleges actually have that requirement.
Why so?
Because they don't want you getting lost. They want to make sure you're in an environment with other people, and they don't want you totally getting lost. So I understand that. Plus, you know, they make a lot of money on their housing as well. Mm-hmm. But no, I think it's a good policy. I think you should be in a dorm or in some kind of structured environment your first year. And then if you want to move out, yeah, then they let us move out our second year. So I did. So the second year I lived in a university-owned apartment, and then third year I just moved into just the community and just had a regular third and fourth years I just had regular apartments just from regular landlords and stuff.
Oh, nice. How did you first meet Mom, and when did you start dating?
So I met Mom, the first time I saw her was actually at a Christmas party, but we didn't really meet. We just kind of passed. And then the next year, she was in charge of a medical clinic, one of our satellite clinics, where I was a resident. And the residents rotate throughout these different clinics. So I rotated out to her clinic, and that's when I met her, because she was the clinical coordinator. I had to work with her every day to, you know, pick lenses and coordinate OR schedules and things like that. So that's when we first met. And we didn't start dating till I changed the rotation and moved on to the next rotation.
Okay.
And that's when we started.
Do you remember the first date?
Yeah. So the first date was really funny. I loved really exotic food. I still like really exotic food. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know at the time. Mom really didn't. and I took her out to a Malaysian restaurant in Boston. There's only one Malaysian restaurant. Yeah. And I love Malaysian food, but it's a little different. And I didn't know this at the time, but apparently she had been out drinking the night before at a party. So she was kind of hungover and not in great shape. But she was like, all right, I'll go out. So I met her downtown, and we went to this Malaysian restaurant, and she was just like looking at the fish in the tank, and she's like, I'm counting those fish, they better not be missing But those were fish to eat. Those weren't decorative fish. Oh, okay. Those were actual, you, that's the one I want. They'll cook it up for you.
It's like the lobsters in the tank?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And she, I don't think she ate the whole night. I think she just sat there talking and listening because she was not in good shape. And and that was our first date. It was pretty funny. I had no idea she did not really appreciate food like that.
Oh, okay. So. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
So you served in the Army, right?
So I was in the National Guard, and we had a program. When I was in medical school, we were approached by a captain at the time. And he was starting up a brand new program where he was going to recruit us in medical school. And all he wanted us to do for our drill, our military drill, was to go to the armory and study. He said, I understand you're students. I understand you can't do stuff. He said, but when you finish, he goes, it's an 8-year commission. And when you finish, we want you to stick around and be a doctor in the Army. So, or in the National Guard, I mean. So it was a fantastic deal. So we got to go to Officers Basic. They flew us down to Fort Sam in San Antonio. Hmm. And we did Officers Basic down there for 2 weeks, which they paid us, which was great, getting paid as a medical student. And then we got to drill every weekend for 1 weekend a month. We would go to the Army. We'd get put on our uniform, go to the Army, bring our books, and we'd study. And that was it. That was our commitment. And then that was, I did 4 years of that. And then, during the summer, we got to go on military electives when we were in third and fourth year. So that's how I got to go to Fitzsimmons Army Medical in Colorado to do radiology, where I was paid a whole month. And they flew me out there, and I got to go in the military housing and do the rotations. And then I did an amazing hand rotation down at Walter Reed with the hand service, microvascular hand service, which was incredible. So I spent a month down there and got to see the Army Pathology Museum, which was amazing because they have like a piece of President Garfield's skull and the bullet that killed him. I mean, they have stuff there that's just incredible.
That's one of the older ones, right?
That's a really old museum, yeah. So it was really great to do stuff like that. And then after I graduated and got my medical license, then I would drill at the armory. I would go out with the troops, and we would go out in the woods. And I got I had a heavy track license, so I could drive the track vehicles. and I'd go to the range. I was a safety officer on the range and fire all the stuff. And
what was your favorite weapon?
The
fire, or
I always liked the M16. That was a lot of fun. The 50 cal machine gun's scary. I never actually fired one because it's really something when it's going off.
Yeah,
it's really something. But my favorite thing in the world were the grenade launcher. So we would have M16s with grenade launchers attached.
Oh, like the underbarrel.
Yeah, and I love grenades. How much fun is that? So we would go to the grenade course. So I actually qualified on the grenade course. So to qualify, you have to, there are various targets out there. And like there's a house with a window, and you have to put the grenade in the window. Oh. And I could nail it from a couple hundred yards out. I could get the grenade right in the window.
Wow.
Yeah. So I loved the grenades. Oh my gosh. Talk about fun. Those things are a riot. So that was probably my favorite.
What was like a daily routine?
You mean work or in the guard?
In the guard.
So in the guard. So typically, when I'd go on, my two week active duty, we would go out in the woods. We were I was with the 182nd Mechanized Infantry out of Fort Drum, New York. So we would go up to Fort Drum, New York, which is like 30 miles south of Canada. So even in July, it can go down to 20 degrees there. I mean, that place is ridiculous. So it'll be 100 during the day and 20 at night. I mean, it's the weather there is just incredible. So we would go up there, and then we would, you know, stage, and then we'd get in the vehicles, and we would go out, and I would set up a battalion aid station. I was a battalion surgeon, so I would run a battalion aid, and every morning from, I think we would start at like 0600 to like 0900, we would do sick call, and the guys would come in, and we would, you know, take care of whatever they had. And then during the day, if anything came up, we would take care of that too, you know. So if someone, let's say somebody got dehydrated and passed out, we'd go pick them up and then hit them with some IV fluids. Or we had a guy jam a machine gun, or actually that was actually a 50 cal that jammed and it exploded back at him, and he had some shrapnel in him. So we had to try to get some of that. And and just stuff like that, just, you know, basically treat people as they came in. And then they would tell us when we had to move, and they'd give us the coordinates, and we would just have to convoy to the new coordinates at night. Our movement was at night, yeah. So we had to pack up and drive through the woods to get to the new spot. And then some people had to go up to support some of the firing ranges, because they have an A-10 range up in Drum, so some of the medics would go up there, which is like a 3-hour drive to get there, and the fly guys, they just fly up, and then sometimes I'd have to go someplace, so we'd jump in a helicopter, and we would fly over to someplace. I probably flew more helicopters down on Cape Cod, because we would train with those guys, and they needed their flight hours, so we would have a mission. So we'd say, all right, I need you to, you know, take us over here, and we'd coordinate the mission, and we'd go, and they'd pick us up and fly us over to wherever part of the base at Cape Cod. So
was it worth it? Did you like it?
Yeah, no, it was really good. I mean, I never actually got into combat. We were put on 1-hour standby for Desert Storm. So we were rated, normally we were rated non-combat status, but when Desert Storm came out, this was right around 1990, you know, we got upgraded to combat status. And I didn't know this at the time, but that meant that our little state budget turned into a federal budget. And every year, my supply officer would tell me to request all of my supplies. I didn't know what that was. I just put it in. He said, just request all your supplies every year. I said, okay. So I would request. And every year I got a call from the Massachusetts state surgeon, and he'd be like, you know, your request is more than my entire budget for the whole year. Is it okay if I send you some antibiotics, some IV fluids, some stuff like that? I'm like, absolutely, go ahead. So he'd send me some supplies because that was state budget. Well, when we were put on combat status, somebody filled my whole request. And I walk into the armory one day, and the armory is filled with stuff. And the supply sergeant comes over to me and says, sir, I need you to sign this. I'm like, oh, what is this? He goes, this is for your supplies. Everything came in today. I'm like, oh, okay, what is it? And I'm looking at it, and he's like, this. And I'm like, from floor to ceiling, I'm talking, there was crate after crate after crate. I'm just like, what? He goes, oh, and there's more. Come with me. So he goes out to the back. There are 6 track ambulances and 2 track ORs.
Jeez.
Mobile ORs. And I'm like, what? He goes, these are yours, sir. And I'm like, they're what? And apparently, that's the way it works. I put in the request. I was authorized $19 million worth of equipment.
Oh, my God.
So I signed for it. I'm like, all right, and I signed for it, and we started training with that stuff, and that's when I got my track license, because we had all those vehicles. We had to drive those things, you know, and I had two platoons in my medical battalion, but that was only about 15 guys total. So I had to drive too sometimes, because we had 8 vehicles. So that's why I got my license, and we would go take the machines down to Cape Cod, and we were bombing around the woods in the track vehicles when we had to go someplace. And when I had to go to an officer's meeting, I would jump in a track vehicle and grab a they call him a TC, a tank commander, to, you know, to spot for me, and we would, I would drive myself to the meeting, and that's how we got around. And when Desert Storm came, so we were on 1 hour standby, so I had all my stuff packed, all my military stuff packed and in my car 24 hours a day, because they said when they called, you had 1 hour to get there.
Oh.
So Desert Storm came, and we were not called up. We were pushed down, and another battalion from, I think, North Carolina, South Carolina, I can't remember, they were called up, and they borrowed my equipment for Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I lost the equipment, I thought, oh, well, they, you know, they're going into combat. So apparently, though, you know, Desert Storm happened, Desert Storm finished, and next thing I know, a couple months later, the equipment comes back.
Oh.
And the supply sergeant says, no, you requested it, and it's yours. So it came back to us, and we were reading the log books, and my equipment was in the absolute lead in the invasion into Kuwait.
Oh, that's cool.
You, when you look at the log books and the dates, they led the charge into Kuwait, yeah, with that equipment. It was really kind of cool. I was like, wow, I'm proud of this equipment. So we didn't get to go. We were ready to go. I was ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
But they never called us up. So.
Huh. What is one person you look up to the most and why?
It's a little controversial, since he got busted with the doping scandal, but Lance Armstrong is still...
Oh, yeah.
I still consider him amazing. You know, the way I look at it is, I mean, I know he got, you know, he finally got busted from the doping. All of those cyclists dope. They all do. That's how they run at that level of intensity.
Mm-hmm.
And just the dope doesn't get you up the mountain. The guy still had to train that hard. He still had to prepare so incredibly and put together a team and put together a strategy. I mean, just the amount of intensity that he put into winning that tour 7 times in a row. Wow. Was just... amazing. I mean, that's a feat that has never been done before or since, and it's sad that it was tarnished, you know, by the whole doping scandal, and even more sad that he lied about it. I can't look up to that he lied about the doping and things like that. I so it's a little awkward.
Mm-hmm.
But the achievement is still amazing. It's still an incredible achievement, you know, doping or not. It's to do that 7 times in a row. Just takes an amount of dedication that is just incredible. So I still do admire his achievement as much as it's kind of sad. It's been tarnished by his actions and his behavior. I can't admire that, but I can separate out the achievement. So pretty incredible.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What's the number one thing on your bucket list?
Ooh, number one thing on my bucket list.
Or like some like long time goal.
Yeah. There are some absolutely epic mountain bike trails in this world, and I would love to do some of those, along with some epic scuba dives as well. Yeah. So I don't know if I have a number one, honestly. I mean, there's just a list of top places. Like, there are some incredible trails up in Reno, Tahoe that are just amazing, and then the famous trails in Moab, Utah are world famous, some of these mountain bike trails. And you know, Truck Lagoon and some of the amazing dive sites. There's a couple dive sites in the world that have just the most amazing wrecks, all these World War II and shipwrecks and stuff. And those would be incredible too. So there, I don't know that I have a number one. I guess if you absolutely positively force me to pick one thing as my top one, wow. I think it would have to be one of the really, really famous trails out at Moab. They are spectacular. Yeah, I probably have to have that as my top.
That'd be cool.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, are those the ones that, like, it's like you pass the highway and there's like that like intersection, like Hurricane or?
Yeah. Well, Hurricane has some great trails, but Moab is about a 6-hour drive from here.
Oh,
so Moab, Utah has some really famous. There's one called the Porcupine Rim that's supposed to be just out of this world. Just amazing views and incredible scenery and just the technical abilities and things like that are really spectacular.
What's the biggest obstacle in your life? Did you overcome it? If so, how?
Wow. The biggest obstacle in my life, believe it or not, well, it's probably easy to believe, was that I have and had a bad habit of lying to myself. And the sneakiest part about lying to yourself is that you don't know you're lying because you convince yourself that you're not. You know, you're your own judge. I'm my own judge. And it's easy to convince myself that that's not really a lie. And then, of course, there's nobody to tell me that it is because I'm basically lying to myself. And when you lie to yourself, that's the most devastating thing you can do.
Okay.
And it's also the hardest thing to break because most of the time I didn't even know I was doing it.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know that I've completely broken it yet because, again, it's so sneaky that it's really hard sometimes to pick out when it's happening and when it isn't. And the best thing I've ever done was read that book, the four agreements, because agreement number one is to be impeccable with your word, and being impeccable with your word means you don't lie to yourself.
Okay.
Because if you think about this, if you don't lie to yourself, well, then you don't lie to others either.
Right.
You know, you can't lie to others but not lie to yourself. Be true to yourself. That's impossible. But if you're lying to yourself, it's easy to lie to others as well because you don't even realize you're doing it. You convince yourself that the lie is true, and then you tell others the lie, but in your brain it sounds true. So that's probably the biggest challenge I've had, and I don't know where I got it from. Obviously, I somehow started doing it, you know, probably as a kid. And been doing it for a long time, and you know, reading the four agreements is what, you know, really helped me see that I was doing it. And I think I'm getting rid of it. I don't know that I have it totally licked. I'm not sure.
All right. What's your greatest achievement, and then after that, what's your greatest like mistake or failure?
Okay. I think my greatest achievement is learning how to learn, and I apply that in a whole bunch of areas, like with surgery, learning how to learn to adapt to new surgeries. That's probably my best achievement, because when you can adapt, it's one thing to get good at a surgery or a technique. But then over time, if you stick with the same technique, it becomes stale and old, and you're no longer on doing the best that you can do. So it's important to learn how to do it better. And I've been able to do that really well in surgery so that I can be at the top end of the curve in doing the latest procedures and figuring out and learning how to do them even better. As far as my greatest failure was not understanding how financial stuff works. and not understanding how just the whole concept of money and and ego and stuff, and how easy it is to get sucked into a way of thinking that's not legitimate. So I ended up losing a lot of money because I got my ego involved in it. And that's a really hard lesson. I don't think I know any investor who hasn't done that at least once, mm-hmm. sometimes more than once. And you end up losing a ton of money because you just get so invested in it. And I think that's probably, that might not be my total greatest failure if we're going to be real honest here.
Oh.
And not lie to myself. I do think, unfortunately, my relationship with your mom is a huge failure.
I think so.
Yeah. I have not done what was really needed to get the relationship where it should be. So I think a lot of her sadness now is because I wasn't there for her. So that could be my greatest failure. I don't know. I have a good list of failures. Maybe that would be an even bigger failure if I'm really going to be true to my word.
Right. Thank you. Where do you see yourself from 10 years now?
10 years from now, I hope I see myself getting ready to retire. I'm thinking I'll probably work about another 10. Yeah, I might not make it 10, but maybe. I'm not sure we'll be living here. Mom doesn't want to live here at all.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So we might not be here. Certainly, if we're still together, we will not be here. I see myself still mountain biking. I see myself still scuba diving. And I see myself still doing something academic, probably trying to teach or somehow. I want to give back somehow. I've always thought I'd move more into an academic setting where I could teach.
That's cool. Because I mean, you have all that experience. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, take the experience and pass it on to somebody. I think would be really cool.
What's the best experience from work that'll stick with you? Any memorable patients?
Yeah, the most amazing thing is in what I do is when you can pull out a really incredible outcome. And it doesn't happen very often. Most things are pretty routine, but every now and then you get one that's just astounding. You know, sometimes somebody will come in and they'll just be in horrible shape. I mean, this one lady was just in just terrible, terrible shape. And I was able to take her to surgery, stabilize the situation, get her vision to come back to a really good level, and really improve her life huge, you know. And that's amazing to be able to do that. It's a real gift and blessing and just extremely rewarding, you know, when I can take somebody who really can't see and then I can get them to see again and stabilize the eye and then they get to see for the rest of their life because of the surgery that I did. That's pretty amazing.
What would be like one day that you could relive in your past if you had to choose, if that makes sense?
So I could pick a day to redo in my past?
Or like relive.
Relive.
Because you want to change it, or like it was just like really good.
Right.
I don't know if you'd remember, because I mean.
Gosh.
But.
One day to do again.
Or you could just choose like a moment.
I mean, yeah. I mean. I don't know. Boy, that's a tough one. That's a really tough one. You know, I mean, if you're talking about relive it because it was so good to have fun, or relive it because it was a disaster and I'd want to fix it.
I guess relive it because it was fun.
Because it was fun. Okay. Wow. I don't know. I've had a lot of really fun experiences. I don't know. I can't think of a single day that was so incredible that I'd want to go back.
Or maybe, like, how about we do the other one and want to change?
Yeah, a disaster that I'd want to undo would be good. There are many days where I wasn't there for mom. I would love to go back and do it better, do it different. Would be really great, you know. Like, you know, like the time, you know, you were diagnosed with the brain cyst, and it would be great to go back and redo that, you know, that day and do that better.
That's cool. Yeah. What's one critical piece of advice you'd give?
Don't borrow money.
That's a big one.
Don't borrow money. Don't get into debt. That would be the most critical thing. Right up there, right next to it, would be Warren Buffett's rule number one. Don't lose money. It's kind of the same thing. Borrowing money is losing money. So don't get into debt. There's very few good reasons to do that.
Yeah. All right. What made you want to marry mom? What's your best experience you had with her? And what's, like, anything you learned valuable?
Mom, when I first met her, started talking with her and stuff, always felt like I knew her already. Always had this feeling like, well, yeah, of course we're together. It was the weirdest feeling. Normally when I go out on a date or if I met a woman I was interested in, I'd be all nervous, I'd be freaking out, I didn't know what I was gonna do. And there was something different with mom. I just felt like, well, yeah, of course we're together. It was the weirdest feeling, and I always had that. And as far as experience we had, it was really cool when we lived in Omaha together. That was a lot of fun. We used to go to the movies. We used to go get ice cream and stuff. Mm-hmm. That was really cool. And as far as what I've learned, she was the one who taught me about truth and honesty and being true and honest with myself more than anybody else. Nobody else could get that message through. She's the one. And her spirituality is really amazing. Yeah. And really amazing. Yeah, she's really very, very devoted, and that's really impressive too.
Mm-hmm. We have a minute 30 left. Is there any, like, final touches you want to say, or is that it?
About the whole process, yeah.
Yeah, something you want to add?
Well, I'd also add, be true to yourself. Be impeccable with your word to the financial advice, you know. No, I mean, I really don't have any regrets. I think everything I've done needed to be done. Definitely things I wish I did better. But everything I've done has kind of brought me to where I am now. And it'll be exciting to see what happens going forward.
Yeah.